Welcome to New Books in the Environment. I'm Jason Schwartz. John Wallum has made a career out of writing about animals and the strange lengths to which people constantly have to go to reconcile sharing a world with them. Sometimes it means spiking our window ledges to keep pigeons from landing there. Other times it means donning elaborate bird costumes to make endangered cranes comfortable enough so we can do for them what they can no longer remember how to do for themselves. In Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America, Wallum takes us to three different places on the North American continent where human communities have developed deep connections with animals at the brink of extinction. What follows is a story of frustration, devotion, love, and ultimately hope. We are also taken on a ride into the arcane, historic backroads of American conservation and asked to wonder about its present and future courses. I'm so pleased to welcome John Wallum to New Books in the Environment. Hey, John, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing, Jason?
Good, thanks. Your book starts in Churchill, Manitoba, which is a town that's basically at the margins of human habitability. And the people who live there live in the vestiges of a former military base. Polar bears congregate there waiting for the Arctic ice to form. And so you have this strange cooperation or cohabitation of people and a large number of polar bears in this place. And a kind of, if it's not symbiosis, it's certainly a strange kind of mutuality is kind of developed between these two populations. Could you describe what life is like there a little bit?
So basically Churchill's right on the western edge of Hudson Bay. So the bears have to come off the ice every summer when the ice disappears, melts away on the bay, and then they've got to wait around on land for the ice to form again in the fall. And so really, you put it exactly the right way. Like this is the one place on Earth where large numbers of polar bears are all congregated in the same place at the same time of year. And it also happens to be where there's this, little town with an airport and a railway station and a hotel and all the kind of the what you need for human habitability. And so what that means is that essentially that the bears can be monetized, right? Because you can plan a trip to see polar bears in Churchill, and it's really hard to do that anywhere else in the world. I mean, otherwise you're just sort of mounting these expeditions into these, vast white wildernesses and hoping that you might cross paths with a bear, or you might see one on the ice from the bow of a cruise ship or something. And so what happened basically after the military pulled out of Churchill in the late 60s, is that, now that the fort there was dismantled and, the town went from about 7,000 people to about, 1,000 people or even less, within a matter of months, basically, the wilderness started, creeping back in, and the bears that had previously steered away from the town now, felt much more comfortable just walking straight through the town or digging in dumpsters and things like that. And people realized that, just as the military, their kind of economic reason for being with the military disappeared, they could revive the town as a tourist destination. And so now every fall, you've got about, 10,000 tourists that filter through the town to get a look at the bears. And you've got a lot of media too, because obviously if you're filming some sort of nature special or something, you want to make sure you've got a good chance of filming polar bears if you're going to invest all that money. And so Churchill has really become this nexus point where people and bears, where the bears are going to be, and therefore where the people can go right to them. And so you've got these kind of weird transactions, I guess, between people and bears going on all fall.
At first, it wasn't so much about people trying to get this last chance at seeing a bear. It was about something else, about fear and danger. How has the transformation sort of been managed by people outside of Churchill, and how has it been managed by people who actually live there and live near the bears?
Yeah, right. So in the early 80s, which is about when the first tourists started coming to Churchill, the appeal was really, that everyone thought of polar bears as these, really bloodthirsty, menacing creatures. And, isn't it cool that you get to go somewhere where you can see one of these things in real life? Because, they're so mysterious and they live in these solitary lives up at the top of the world. And actually, there was a National Geographic special called Polar Bear Alert that came out in the 80s, which pretty much jump-started the tourist industry there, where they filmed the town and they showed, men walking around with, their babies and a rifle over their shoulder, because this was a place that was, being yeah, you know, the bears are sort of, you know, these phantoms that roamed around the town. And there, that was the tone. The tone was of danger and kind of the allure of the danger of being so close to polar bears. And then in the mid-2000s, when climate change really started to peak in public consciousness and the polar bear became this kind of icon for climate change, a lot of the tourism now has flipped into what, you know, one academic paper I saw called Last Chance Tourism, where basically people are coming to see these bears before they disappear, because the bears around Hudson Bay are probably going to be the first population to go as well. And that's been really, you know, good for the tourism industry. And that's been really good for the NGOs that are working up there, to kind of put the spotlight on Churchill and on the polar bears that way. But I think it's, you know, basically what I was surprised to see is just how confusing and even infuriating it's been for people who live in the town, because these are, you know, nearly everyone I met in town who you know, resident of Churchill, does not believe climate change is a real thing. I mean, they see changes in the climate, they tend to think that it's a cyclical thing, or, you know, or they just don't buy the idea that even if the climate changes, that polar bears are just going to starve on land and that they're not going to figure out some other way to survive. And I think, you know, as far as I could understand it, it really seemed to be because these people lived around polar bears. They lived in actual proximity to polar bears, and that they had real one-to-one experiences with bears over the years. And they knew these animals to be, you know, very intelligent, very kind of creative animals that they had to respect as neighbors. And so the bear that they knew was not the same bear that you see, you know, in these commercials for, you know, like, you know, when you see the image of the polar bear on a stranded on an ice floe or something, just sort of looking forlorn and helpless. That is not the same bear that they know. And I think they really have become resentful of the environmentalists and all the celebrities and TV news crews that, you know, come through town every year, because they see them as cheapening this animal, you know, using this animal to forward some kind of environmental agenda, and really not honoring, you know, what the animal that they know it to be.
For whose sake are we keeping these bears? I mean, for what reason would we keep these around as keepsakes?
Yeah, well, I mean, I should clarify. I mean, that was my term. Right. You know, no conservationist talked about it that way. But I talked about it that way because, really, you know, I felt like that's what we were talking about at this point. And I think it brings up, you know, a whole host of different, you know, issues as you're mentioning. But the idea that I think it's important to go back a little bit. So basically the, you know, the polar bear became this icon of climate change because it was one of the first species where we had very clear science about how climate change was going to affect a species and how exactly it was going to drive a certain species extinct. You know, there had obviously been a lot of science about climate change, but in terms of these very narrow studies about its effects on a particular species, excuse me, the polar bear was really the first, you know, and definitely the first kind of charismatic megafauna species that we had that information for. And so the idea became, if you could get people to care about the polar bear, you could get people to, you know, care about combating climate change, and you could use it as a kind of mascot to rally people behind. And I think what you're seeing now is that, you know, even in the last 10 years or so, since this idea, this kind of synergy between polar bear conservation and climate change activism happened, the time has run out for a lot of polar bear populations, or at least we've now understand the situation better, and the consensus is that time is very close to running out for almost all of them, except for these ones at the very top of the world. And so you start to see the tactics, you know, forking now into, you know, what can save polar bears and what can stop climate change. And if we're still just talking about saving polar bears by, you know, revamping energy policy or carbon taxes or whatever it is going to be in a kind of holistic way to combat climate change, then even if those changes were to start happening really dramatically, you know, this afternoon, we would still really only be able to save a very small number of polar bears. And I think, not to say that's not worthwhile, I'm just sort of laying out, you know, realistically what we're talking about. Whereas you get all these other people, and a lot of the people, for example, that I met in Churchill, who say, well, if we want to save polar bears, we should be, you know, putting food out for them, because that's what they need, right? They're off ice. They're not eating while they're stranded on land. And so really, by the time I got to Churchill, the ideas of or the practice of saving polar bears and fighting climate change had in many cases become two separate things. And so I think that the idea that you're going to save, you're going to combat climate change to save one population of polar bears up at the very north of the world, I think that's an honorable thing. And I would much rather live in a world with one population of polar bears than no population of polar bears. But I think that, to say that, to save, to fix the climate is to save polar bears is just almost a ridiculously disingenuous statement at this point.
Right.
And it's also like, it's not the best reason to fight climate change is to save, a small pocket of polar bears close to the North Pole. There's much more compelling reasons, to fight climate change. And I honestly think at this point too, there's much, since we've had, Sandy and, kind of other weather events, that people are starting to internalize as caused by climate change, there's even more compelling reasons, I think, that you could rally people behind than polar bears. And I think you see that. You don't see environmentalists really talking about polar bears to the same extent.
No, it almost seems like their 15 minutes are, like, it's at 14:45, doesn't it, with the polar bears?
Exactly, yeah. And when I was in Churchill, it was like you could really see that was at the – and that's what I write about, for the most extent, is sort of how the polar bear was on the verge of jumping the shark, Yeah. You really started to see it. And I think it's because, because of what I'm talking about, because the reality of the situation and all of its complexities was starting to be, of the polar bear situation was starting to, really come into relief. And once you see the complexities of actually, of preserving a species like the polar bear, you realize that it's not really a tidy symbol for this other larger problem.
Well, I mean, and I think that some groups and some people might even think of protecting the polar bear as goal one and climate change as a means for seeking protection for the polar bear. I mean, you take, Center for Biodiversity, which has traditionally used the Endangered Species Act to, to get the United States to keep to its promises of protecting species and ecosystems. And their tack has been, as you outline in your book, their tack has been to try to get protection for the polar bear through climate change. Could you describe a little bit about their use of Endangered Species Act and maybe a little bit about the strangeness of that act and sort of everybody's surprise that it's still going?
Yeah. So I tell this story in the book because I was really curious to see, so I should say also, when I was like shopping the book proposal around to editors in New York, one editor actually like suggested, well, maybe you don't want to write about polar bears because they're kind of overexposed now, And I thought that like, that's exactly why I want to write about polar bears. How does an endangered species, like how does an animal that lives where no people live become overexposed? Right. And so I wanted to tell that story. I wanted to sort of piece together how this had all happened. And it largely had to do with the Center for Biological Diversity in 2005, I believe. It may have been 2006. I think it was 2005. Had filed a petition to list the bear under the Endangered Species Act. And this was really in the book, both in my learning about this and also in the way I lay it out in the book, this was how I got to know about the ins and outs of the Endangered Species Act and sort of some of the surprising idiosyncrasies of the law. But basically, they were really just looking to confront the Bush administration with climate science. This was at a time when even, getting in a legal context, getting the government to concede that, carbon emissions caused climate change was very difficult. And so, there was efforts to do it using the Clean Air Act and all sorts of other different legal devices. And then Cassie Siegel and Brendan Cummings, these two attorneys at the Center for Biological Diversity, had these really kind of brilliant ideas that, we can use the Endangered Species Act to do it, because when you petition for a species to be listed, the government has to look at the, quote, best available science to assess how serious the threat to that species is. And if we could find an animal that's going to be driven extinct by climate change, we will force them to assess and rule on that science in the context of the Endangered Species Act. And they'd actually tried other species before the polar bear. So they had the strategy, and then they were looking for the right animal to plug into it.
Yeah, they tried some Kittlitz murrelet and maybe a
Kittlitz
spider.
The murrelet. Yeah. They had the Glacier Bay wolf spider at first, and had the seabird called the Kittlitz murrelet. Yeah. And the problem was is that the administration was able to basically duck, you know, they kind of wiggled out of this trap that Cassie and Brennan were setting for them by calling these animals, these species, warranted but precluded, which is this weird loophole that I had no idea about, which basically just means that you can say, yes, this species is under threat. It's going to go extinct and we should be offering it protection under the Endangered Species Act, but we're just a little bit too busy right now. So we're going to kind of shove it through this loophole into this waiting room of species called the candidate list, and we can just leave it there indefinitely. And then, you know, ever since the Clinton administration, people had been presidential administrations have been doing this to species, so that there'd just been this huge backlog piling up. And that was what happened with the Kitlitz's murrelet. But when they did the polar bear, they were able to you know, sort of this like interesting kind of chess game, right? Because when you have the polar bear, then you can kind of neuter their the way they've neutered your strategy, and so if they're going to put something on the candidate list, you get the most charismatic, cuddly, awesome thing you can think of, so that people, the public, will actually care. And so that if they put that on the candidate list and say, well, we're not going to really bother protecting the polar bear right now, yeah, you know, there would actually be public concern about that, and so it becomes politically impossible. And so that was why the polar bear worked. It's you know, all this kind of gushing that was happening in the media and the public, and all these kids who were writing letters to the Bush administration with drawings of polar bears drowning, and you know, people coming dressed like polar bears to hearings wearing life preservers and stuff. All this stuff actually mattered, you know, in the legal context, because it really boxed the Bush administration in. And so, I mean, I can go on, because actually then the Bush administration kind of had this other kind of maneuver where they were able to kind of thwart Cassie and Brennan again. But in terms of clearing that first hurdle, that was, you know, what I was really surprised to learn, that what had looked like a kind of superficial pop, you know, culture craziness for polar bears was actually very valuable legal assets.
Only valuable because of the structure of the Environmental Species Act, which permitted all this activity.
Exactly. I mean, but that, you know, I think you realize that when you're look at any law, basically, that, you know, the letter of the law and the idealism behind a particular law spells out that things should happen a certain way. And then it's basically just kind of like a, you know, a pile on of attorneys on either side that figure out how they're going to either get around that law or hold the government to the letter of the law.
Well, speaking of pylons of attorneys and embattled bears, in our home state of New Jersey, we're entering, I don't know, it's the third or something year of the state-sanctioned bear culling, which is the state's terminology, I think. It's a, you know, it's a yearly state-sanctioned bear hunt based on the premise that human and bear conflict is happening too much. And a term that you often see used by people who justify this hunt, which is, you know, obviously providing diminishing returns over time. I mean, hunters are giving up now because so-called nuisance bears are harder and harder to find. Go figure. But one of the terms that you often see to justify this hunt is cultural carrying capacity. And that's always seemed a bit of a dubious term to me, a term that it's sort of meant to signify how much of a species human civilization can tolerate nearby, or just tolerate in general. It's always seemed like a means of justifying something like a bear culling. But in your book, you kind of take a more holistic position on the term. How do you take cultural carrying capacity, and what do you think of as its significance in this conversation?
Yeah, I actually think it's a brilliant term. You know, it was there were several moments in, you know, when I was reporting the book where I would hit on a term like this, you know, that just suddenly explained so much to me. You know, so many of the things I'd been seeing, now I had a way to think about them, and this was definitely one of them. And I think it's, you know, I would completely disagree with you. I mean, I think it's not dubious at all. I think actually it's the one thing that matters right now in terms of, you know, what species are going to stick around on the planet or not, is basically how much we want to tolerate them. And you know, usually you see it applied to things like deer or wild turkeys, or, you know, bears in some cases, you know, things that we actually have we live in proximity to and we have close contact with. How many deer are we going to have? Well, we're going to have as many deer as we're going to have before they really start pissing people off, or until, Lyme disease spikes, or we're going to have as many bears as we're going to have until they start turning up, on kids' trampolines and backyards. But I also think there's a broader way to think about it. I think it's back to this Endangered Species Act stuff, which is that, even animals like the Kittlitz's murrelet, which, there are really only a handful of people in the world who have even seen this bird, and virtually all of them are biologists who study the bird. It lives like on these glacial ice sheets. Even an animal like that did not get Endangered Species Act protection, did not get money and, federal employees and energy and more science devoted to it because we didn't care about it, because we didn't care because no one cared about it enough to put pressure on the Bush administration when it decided it was going to put it in this warranted but precluded category. And I'd say that's just another dimension of sort of cultural carrying capacity, that we're making decisions about what lives and dies and what we want where all the time, not just for these animals like raccoons or something that we would actually see in our neighborhoods.
Yeah, I mean, in that way, conservation of species has so much to do with a world that we can imagine living in, a world that we want to structure. And it's, I think one of the reasons that the term has always seemed dubious to me is it is a reaction to that instinct, but maybe a reaction to that kind of instinct or a negative reaction to that kind of instinct is naive. At this point in time, there is some truth to the notion that we are determining. I mean, if it's not already obvious that we're in the so-called sixth extinction and climate change is very much a reality, that we are structuring the world as we want to see it. And in many ways, the animals that get to stay around are the ones that are either able to make us like them or adapt to the world that we're structuring.
Yeah, well, and I also think it's not always intentional. We're doing tons of things by accident, but we're still the ones doing them. And even, there's a moment in the book too where I'm talking about, success, conservation success. And then, like black bears, I mean, that right. The fact that they're nuisances now is in some measure a success of conservation.
Gigantic quotation marks around the term nuisance, of course.
Right, exactly. Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just more cynical than you, but I would consider it a nuisance if there's, maybe not for the amount of bears that are in New Jersey, but, if I was having, multiple black bears walk through my backyard and I have a toddler at home, I would consider that a nuisance. That to me seems legitimate. But in any case, but I think that, you see it a lot with species where they do rebound, where all our hard work pays off. And then suddenly it's like, we're not quite sure why did we want these things around. You see this with, farmers who are having their crops trampled by various birds and things like that. There's always this kind of tension between, kind of romanticizing certain animals and wanting to make sure that they stick around. And then also not always being sure how to actually coexist with them.
Is there some deeper bridge between the way that children view animals and the way that we mean for our children to view animals in their early days and our instincts or some people's instincts for conservation?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different ways to answer that question. And I think, just maybe the most straightforward way that I've come to understand it is, the fact that we surround kids with animals, the fact that, we read them stories about animals and show them movies about animals, and that if we're outside, and they say, look, a butterfly, like, that's like a kind of gives you a warm feeling, I mean, I think all this to me in a very fundamental way just is proof that being a species that lives among other species is really important to us. And that on some basic level, the fact that we are trying to get our kids plugged into the world of wildlife means that it's important to us, in the same way that, we teach kids the golden rule or we teach kids to share, these sort of very basic fundamental values that, in adult life are always more complicated than they seem for a 4-year-old. Animals is one of them. To be interested in animals, to be aware of animals, seems to be something that we're all teaching our kids. And so to me, that's like the most hardcore simplest way to interpret all this. And I think that was really eye-opening for me, because when you talk to, even when I would describe the book to people and I'd say, well, yeah, I'm going to take my daughter to see endangered species in the wild. Like, you know, people would, you could see like, you know, they would respond to that in an emotional way, just like that one sentence, you know, mm-hmm. It was very evocative for them. And I think it's like all things that we talk about children with, it's just kind of a window into what our kind of deepest values are. We don't talk to our kids about like hedge funds and, you know, try to get them to understand, you know, finance or politics so much, you know, but we do. We do that with nature.
Well, I mean, your book, you know, it's called The Wild Ones, a sometimes dismaying, weirdly reassuring story about looking at people, looking at animals in America. And despite the quirkiness and I think perfectness of the subtitle, it's actually the major title, the whatever that publishing word is, wild
the title.
Wild Ones, that is so melancholy to me. There's a hint there of like envy and sort of missingness, you know. Wild Ones, those ones, the ones over there, the ones that get to still be wild. And it's that kind of melancholy that I think infuses the book and actually infuses the actions of many of the conservationists who are working in your book, who are basically giving over their lives or major parts of their lives and their best years in the service of conserving species that would not survive without their help. And that's a great place to transition to talking about the butterflies, because you go from this very charismatic species, the polar bear, which, you know, everybody is overseeing at this point, to a obscure butterfly living in a very obscure post-industrial sort of wasteland. It's called the Lang's Metal Mark Butterfly. Can you describe just briefly what is happening there to preserve this little insect?
Yeah, so this is a butterfly that lives on a little piece of land, which is actually a National Wildlife Refuge now, called the Antioch Dunes National Wildlife Refuge. And it's situated in this town, Antioch, right between San Francisco and Sacramento. On the one side of the refuge is only about 60 acres, I guess. So it's one of the smallest national wildlife refuges in the U.S. There's a river on one side and a waste treatment facility on the other side, and there's a railroad tracks and a little biker bar. It's not what you think of when you think of a wildlife refuge. And basically for 100 years, ever since the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, the sand had been mined out of it. They were first started mining it to make bricks to rebuild the city, and then it was used for, you know, a whole host of things since then. And so the ecosystem just completely unraveled. You had a disturbance ecosystem, these sand dunes, that now there were no dunes. So weeds were, invasive plants were coming in, and just, you know, the plants that the butterfly relied on were having a hard time competing. But somehow this butterfly managed to hang on long enough to get people's attention, and it was one of the first insects ever listed as an endangered species in the early or late 70s, I guess. And by the early 80s, the government had bought the property and went about trying to protect the butterfly. Basically fast forward to now, and you've got an ecosystem that's completely being run by people. You know, the machinery of that ecosystem is just ground to a halt. And so you've got a full-time Fish and Wildlife Service employee who is essentially just walking around the property, pulling invasive plants out and planting these native buckwheat that the butterfly needs. You've got a biologist in Southern California who's breeding the butterflies in captivity and then driving up with larvae every spring and walking around the property, placing the larvae on the leaves of the buckwheat as though she were like a female butterfly laying eggs around the refuge. They're very open about the fact that it's just, you know, we're doing everything for this place at this point. There's really no scenario where you can imagine this ecosystem just kind of, you know, starting up again and running on its own.
So both the survival of this butterfly in this very small little fingernail of a place, and the survival of the ecosystem that would preserve it are reliant upon conservation. And that's actually a term that I'd never heard before, conservation reliance. And it's a term that, but it's a theme that pretty much infuses the book, that there is now in many places in the world, a form of wildlife that is utterly dependent upon very direct human maintenance of many of their natural behaviors just so that they can survive. That's very interesting, and that's a very interesting part of the book. But sort of equally interesting and more quiet in the book is your discussion of a different kind of species unto itself. It's that conservationist species, the devotee, the diehard who goes to extreme lengths to keep these conservation reliant species like the metal mark or the whooping crane around. And it got me to thinking about another kind of reverse direction of conservation reliance. Does conservation reliance somehow illuminate as a term the relationship that some of these conservationists have to the upkeep of their particular species?
So, like, is it a codependent relationship?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think so. I mean, I would say absolutely yes, but I worry that right. somehow cheapens it, you know. And I think that, I mean, to me, it's. I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, this. Getting to know the people doing these projects and actually spending, you know, huge amounts of time with them was, to me, just the real pleasure of doing this book. I mean, the ideas are nice. You know, it's interesting in an intellectual way to learn about kind of the planet we're living on right now. But it wouldn't have held my interest for 3 years writing the book if it weren't, you know, that all those ideas were being animated by these real people who often were not who I expected them to be. I mean, there's very few scientists in the book. You know, most of who the people I ended up spending time with are, you know, kind of very extremely well regarded and educated amateurs, you know, who got into their particular project in a kind of a sideways way and are often really surprised at how their life has turned out.
Yeah. You have people coming there who are, you know, who are just residents who live nearby places, or people who are coming there to sort of escape another form of life or to just further relationships with people and found themselves deeply involved with animals. And it's the kind of myriad ways that people get involved in and then end up staying that I agree. It's I mean, you say it's the kind of major experience of your writing the book, but it's definitely the major experience of reading the book is developing relationships and you go into pretty good depth with a lot of the people who you meet and it is kind of incredible that they began as amateurs and in their experience in this very small niche with a very particular species had become the foremost experts in the world in the conservation of their relative species. What is shifting baseline syndrome? That's something that I hadn't really come across all that much either. Can you describe what that is?
Yeah, so this was something that I discovered in the context of Antioch Dunes. It was another case where I was, you know, learning about a particular place or particular person, and then it turns out there's a scientific concept that explains it perfectly. You know, basically, I had gotten to know this entomologist named Jerry Powell at Berkeley, who is I think in his mid 70s now, and he was one of the first or one of the people that who's still around who had been to Antioch Dunes the furthest back in history. So he had gone for the first time I think in the early 50s, and really back then. This little, you know, horrible scrap of land that we see now was really a wonderland for entomologists. There were all these different insect communities. There was a full spread in Life magazine about all the different insects that lived there and what an amazing place this was and how unique. And Dr. Powell had basically seen this place destroyed over the course of his life and had been trying to study that decline. And he did a really interesting study where he tried to chart, you know, looking at museum specimens that had been collected there over the years, he tried to chart when different species disappeared from the dunes, when no one could go there and collect them anymore. And what he found actually was the opposite. He found that the biodiversity was increasing. Because, or it appeared to be increasing because he kept seeing as the years went on, more and more different kinds of species being collected rather than fewer species. And he was able to explain this because he had an epiphany and he thought about entomologists' nets and that the way over the years, the holes in the netting had gotten smaller and smaller so that you could trap smaller insects, and that people's attention had turned to smaller insects. So the first people that went to Antioch Dunes, looked at, caught all the big sexy stuff. And then that sort of declined. And then the next generation came along and looked for smaller insects, and to the point where he was like burrowing around in the dirt and trapping nocturnal stuff. And so this opened into this idea of shifting baselines, which basically just means that, every generation accepts the version of the world as normal in a sense. I mean, it's in a narrow sense, it's like their data is pegged to the beginning of their career, and they can measure declines against that baseline. But then the next generation comes along and they make their baseline the beginning of their career, or i.e. the end of the previous generation's career, so that each generation is only getting a little narrow portion of the line graph in front of them. And it's hard to really zoom out and see those changes that are happening over the generations. So for example, when Jerry Powell first went to the Antioch Dunes, the people in the generation older than him already thought the place was destroyed. They had lost interest in it as a study site, whereas he thought it was still this amazing place full of all these fascinating insects. And of course, by this time, he's given up on the place. I mean, decades ago, he thought it was ruined, but there's a new generation of entomologists that is still out there trying to preserve what's there. So it's kind of I don't really know what to do with that idea, to be honest. On the one hand, it's very reassuring that every generation seems to have this capacity to find beauty and be fascinated by whatever left. On the other hand, it's sort of terrifying because empirically the damage is just stacking up in the background, whether we notice it or not.
In discussing the butterfly, you say that species taxonomy actually complicates conservation or makes it difficult. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So the Endangered Species Act, it's, the things that are being protected are species. That term is used broadly to mean both species and subspecies, but you can't say I want endangered species protection for, some butterflies that live on this land. You have to have an actual, taxonomic designation. You have to say it's this particular species, here's how it's defined, and here's what separates it from other species. And that's obviously very reasonable because this is a law. It needs to be applied to a very well defined set of organisms. The problem is, and I think there's a legal scholar at Berkeley named Holly Doremus who has just written so brilliantly about this, and basically everything I know about this is rooted in her work. But what you have now is you have a law with its very, its insistence to be very left-brained about everything and define everything very narrowly and in an ironclad way, rubbing up against nature, which is not often defined in a very narrow ironclad way. And actually species, in the case of many species, there's this kind of blur of variability that taxonomists' job is to go in and carve up into tidy categories. And so there's been all kinds of arguments over the years, especially people who want to challenge the protected status of a species, be it because they want to build somewhere or, some kind of development thing or water rights thing, whatever it is, have tried to undermine protection for species by showing that particular species is not really unique. There's been this long running case in Colorado about the Preble's jumping mouse, it's called. It's a little field mouse. And there's been all sorts of arguments about, is this field mouse that's in this part of Colorado really so different from this other one that I think maybe in Kansas or somewhere like that, and trying to kind of just chip away at these lines that we've drawn between species and show the fungibility there, and it is problematic. I mean, I think in the case of the Lang's metal mark, I discovered that there are actually butterflies that are almost the genetic equivalent of these butterflies that live on Mount Diablo, just in a neighboring county, that aren't at the Antioch Dunes. And they don't look like the Lang's metal mark. So if for a taxonomist, they're a different species because we define butterfly species by their physical appearance. On the other hand, there are butterflies that look exactly like Lang's metal marks. And they're much further down, the state south of Antioch Dunes. And they're not genetically related, to this, hardly at all, in compared to these other butterflies. So when you look for an empirical kind of rational answer to what is the species we're protecting, it's really hard to do.
So what are people protecting?
Well, that's a good question. So I think, you can make, I guess in the end, I didn't really I didn't really know what the best way to answer that is. And so you could say we're protecting the genes of this butterfly. But in fact, we're not, because even, you know, I had entomologists tell me, or lepidopterists tell me that theoretically you could go to Mount Diablo, take these butterflies and just sort of selectively breed them almost like they were like, you know, AKC dogs, right. Purebred dogs and create Lang's metalmark butterflies again. So you can't really say we're protecting the genetics. You can't really say we're protecting the appearance because we have butterflies that look just like it. You could say we're protecting a butterfly, this particular butterfly that lives in this particular place. And I think that's a good one, except that the place where they lived is now completely changed from what it used to be. And I think in the end, you know, what I feel like this is the way that Jana Johnson, who's the woman who's breeding the butterflies in captivity, explained it to me, is that we're protecting something unique. We're protecting the idea that there is a butterfly that lives on this land in Antioch, and that that arrangement of butterfly and landscape does not exist anywhere else. And she compared it almost to, like, you know, restaurants. Like, you don't want every restaurant on the highway to be an Applebee's. You know, you want some mom and pops. And I think that there is value to that. You know, I think that there is value to celebrating what is specific to a particular place, even if the place is completely different than it once was. Can I make an argument that protecting this butterfly is more important than protecting, you know, some other species? Not really. Can I make an argument that protecting this butterfly is more important than building a power plant down the road, which they're trying to do? To be honest, I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure how I feel about that. There are very good reasons to build a power plant there, you know. So maybe this is a case where we just want to let it go. But I do celebrate the idea that there are people who think that this is a beautiful thing that exists in one place, and therefore it's worth saving. Because I think, frankly, we need more energy like that. Otherwise, we will lose all those unique things.
Yeah, I mean that kind of creativity, or even just the faith that relationship to that animal and to that place means something is, I mean, though very nuanced and complex way of expressing the importance of something, it's a real conviction. It's a conviction that I think probably is bolstered by people going out into the wild and if we can use the word wild, go out into the wild and seeing those animals perform there as they would normally perform. It's that behavior means something. I mean, whether or not that in the kind of system evaluation that the meaning of that behavior equates to the meaning of a power plant, that's another question. But to say that it doesn't mean something is understandably viewable, I think, as an impoverishment.
And I think that it's a sort of unfortunate that we end up talking about these things in the specific, because it's very hard, I think, to make, you know, a completely irrefutable argument for the preservation of any one species.
Right.
But I think that, you know, there's a larger principle that you know, it's worth, I'm very glad there are people who are really making that argument for all these species, because some of them are going to prevail. and I guess, you know, for me, you know, not to oversimplify, but in the general, it's most important, I think, that some of them prevail rather than that any one particular one does.
What does the human crane hybrid look like to you? What is that creature?
Yeah. Well, so here's a case, you know, going from the butterfly to the whooping crane, where you really see, you know, what prolonged human involvement on the order of what's happening with the butterfly looks like after, you know, 90 years, basically, or 80 years, I guess. You know, there were 14 to 16 wild whooping cranes left in the late 1930s. And ever since then, you know, people and whooping cranes have just been, you know, increasingly more entangled in all sorts of bizarre and very intimate ways. And in some ways, it's very affirming, because you see that what, you know, the whooping crane looked as hopeless and as desperate and sort of as absurd as the butterfly can look now in the 1930s. And now it actually looks a lot better. you know, in the sense that there are many more whooping cranes. There's about 300 whooping cranes in the population that once had 16, and now they're starting to get this other population up and running in the eastern part of the country. So that's a huge success in some ways, and something that would have been, you know, unimaginable. I mean, I can't imagine a scenario like that happening with the butterfly, and yet here, you know, basically this tells me that it's possible, given enough time and enough ingenuity. On the other hand, it's still very desperate. It's still, you know, sort of on the knife edge of extinction. And the trouble that they're having in getting this new population going in the eastern U.S. it just shows you how complicated it can be, where you basically have birds being raised in captivity by people in white costumes so that the birds don't imprint on the people and think that they're people and become sexually attracted to people instead of birds.
Which has happened before.
Which has happened before, yes. And then you've got the people, these guys in a nonprofit called Operation Migration, who lead the birds on a migration from Wisconsin to Florida in ultralight airplanes, still wearing the costumes, not talking around the birds, so that the birds who would normally learn migration from their parents can learn how to migrate, because their parents are still back in the lab in Maryland, and they've been plopped down at this refuge in Wisconsin without any kind of guides. So this is the hybrid creature, I guess, is that it's a very much a cooperative effort between birds and people to teach these birds what they need to know. On the other hand, the vision, you know, this was undertaken with the idea that this would all be phased out eventually, that once there were enough birds who had learned to migrate and had grown to maturity and were breeding themselves, that people wouldn't be necessary anymore. And that's actually taken a lot longer than anyone thought, partly because the birds are having trouble breeding. They abandon their nests at the refuge, and there's a few theories why. It seems likely that it's a problem with a black fly infestation, that the birds are just kind of being harassed by these flies. But there is a possibility that it's also, you know, somehow there's a glitch in these birds, you know, programming, I guess, to use a computer metaphor, which is sort of offensive, but that somehow raising these cyborg whooping cranes. so that raising, you know, whooping cranes in white costumes somehow doesn't teach them what they need to know to be good parents. And as far as I know, that's still an open debate, although the black fly thing seems like it's picking up more credibility, but I haven't checked in with it lately.
Go ahead.
So I was just going to say, so for the time being, you know, we're still living in this, you know, it's a very conservation reliant sort of system where literally, you know, we could breed these birds and put them in Wisconsin, but they will, you know, they may freeze to death or if we don't actually lead them behind these planes and get them to Florida.
I mean, it's a particular case and it's an extreme case, but it is a model for many of these wild populations that we have to kind of prod and bully and cajole into surviving, you know?
Absolutely.
I mean, from you know, species that we have to, that we tell ourselves we have to cull, to species that we have to guide in their migrations, to species that we've got to sort of shock to keep them in places where they're going to be safe. There is a culture among conservationists of bullying animals into being themselves. And it's a pretty fine line between conservation there and domestication.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Is that when you are in control of so much, and not just doing things purposefully, but then realizing that when you don't do things purposely, there are consequences that are unanticipated and that complicate it. So then you have to step back in. I mean, it describes something called the otter free zone, right, which was like, you know, this scheme in the started in the 80s in Southern California, where we were reintroducing otters, and then we had problems because, you know, fishermen didn't want them around and there was offshore oil exploration going on. So the government actually said, okay, we'll set up an otter free zone. And if otters go into this particular area of the ocean, which I think was like the size of Texas, you know, we will get them out and move them, you know? And so basically, once you set these things in motion, if you've set them in motion, in a way, you have to take responsibility for them as well, you know, once they're in motion. And so I think that the whooping crane thing, you know, it definitely looks ridiculous, but only because of the airplanes and the costumes. In terms of the intensity of the effort, you know, it's really representative, I think, of a whole wave of conservation work that's going on right now.
Yeah, and it sort of brings into relief what, I mean, just coming back around to the notion of wildness, it brings into relief a kind of commodity that is wildness, a thing that we are trading in and building whole industries into, and investing or doing our best to invest animals with, so that we can know that it exists out there.
And yeah, it's very much, I mean, I think that's that, you know, people talk about utilitarian views of wildlife, and we want to preserve elk so that we can hunt them or things like that. And then the opposite of that is a kind of more aesthetic, or moral, or, you know, there's these different categories that Stephen Keller developed.
But
actually, exactly. I would actually argue that in some way, all values are utilitarian, because we want to use the wild animals as to know that they're there, that gives us a pleasure. It's still to satisfy a human desire. You know, we may not be directly interacting with it in the way that we're shooting it or that we actually use it, but we do use it in a kind of a psychic way. You know, sometimes we want a species to still be on a particular piece of land because we just want to not feel like we drove it extinct. And that basically, you know, I take the view that these are all of these recoveries in some ways are designed to serve human values. And it's just a matter of parsing out how you feel about those different values and which ones you feel like are more important.
Is there something that we're protecting ourselves from by protecting wildness out there? Is there something that about wildness that we feel like we need around?
Well, I think there's definitely a longing. I mean, you see throughout history, you know, people didn't talk about animals this way 100 years ago. You know, no one celebrated, well, no, 100 years, maybe not 150 years ago, you know. It wasn't until about the turn of the, you know, from in the late 1800s, early 1900s, that people started to romanticize animals in the way where, you know, you could look at think about a bear and think about it as being this pure kind of competent thing that was doing its thing in the woods. And, you know, didn't that make us feel good about the richness of planet Earth? You know, before that, it was like this monster that wanted to eat your chickens. You know, it was more like the way we would see rats than the way we see a bear now. So I think that, you know, given the kind of lives we lead, I think it's really natural that we would want to know that there was something else out there. We want to know that there's something that was more from where we came from than maybe where we're heading.
Right, exactly. It's like when you live near a tiger and that tiger is stalking you and you know, putting everything that you have, life and property, at risk, you're probably not so likely to appreciate the tiger being there. But when you're far away, you want to know it's there.
Yeah, and I don't think that's I don't think that undermines the cause of conservation at all.
So,
you know, I think it's like the kind of romance of animals and their imaginative value is maybe in some ways the most important purpose a lot of species are serving right now. And I do wish there was a way for conservationists to talk about that more without feeling like they were setting themselves up for getting attacked. I mean, in the same way that, you know, we talk about art or, you know, historic preservation or, you know, all of these things that we don't feel the need to justify you know, but by some empirical scientific value. There's just a consensus that emotionally or imaginatively, these are important parts, you know, important facets of the planet. I mean, I understand it's hard to maybe go before a congressional committee and get the kind of funding you need, if that's your argument. But I do really hope that conservationists can figure out a more compelling way to talk about those values, because I think ultimately those are the things that really resonate with people more than, you know, apex predators restoring grassland or whatever it is, you know.
John Mualim, it is always an education to talk with you.
Oh, thanks, man. You too.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye, Jason.
Bye. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody. The theme music for today's show was written and recorded by the band Black Prairie. It's from their musical accompaniment to John's book, a record called Wild Ones, a musical score for the things that you might see in your head when you reflect on certain characters and incidents that you read about in the book. It can be found at blog.blackprairie.com. And please, if you haven't already, go out and read John's book, Wild Ones. I promise we left the best parts for you.